are you doing? Man, it's good to be with you guys. To those of you who are a part of our Crossing Inside family, and to those of you who serve to make the Crossing Inside a reality, God bless you. I absolutely love getting to see all of those baptisms and lives changed, because a lot of people would give up on them, but not our God and not his people. And I want you to know we are in your corner. On Easter weekend this year, we started a brand new sermon series called If. We all have questions. And here at The Crossing, we believe that we all deserve answers. This sermon series, if we're being straightforward, is designed to help those who have a faith strengthen it. To those who've lost their faith, to help them to find it. And to those who want a faith, an opportunity to start it. And I want to welcome all of you joining from all of our different locations, those of you who are part of our online family, as well as those of you who are part of The Crossing Inside. Each week, we are doing our best to navigate some questions regarding the foundation of our faith in Jesus Christ. And our goal is that as our faith is strengthened, that our love and devotion to God would be deepened. Now, while we're going through this sermon series, there might be some of you with this newfound knowledge trying to go around thumping people with it, right? But listen to what it says in 1 Corinthians. Paul says this, "Knowledge puffs up, while love builds up." Our newfound knowledge and understanding is not a license for you to go around pummeling people with arguments and debate. That's not how we're supposed to operate. It should inform our ability and our approach to loving the people around us. But I don't want you going around clubbing people. Well, have you thought of this? Okay, that's not, because listen, as Christians, those of you who call The Crossing home, okay, here's the deal. Our goal is not to win arguments. Although we might win some arguments, but we're not trying to get into an argument and absolutely just pummel somebody for the sake of an argument, okay? We're trying to do something better than that. This is what we're trying to do. Our goal is to win people to Jesus, okay? Let me put it this way. Let me explain it. Have you ever won an argument? Raise your hand, ladies, married ladies, okay? We get it, all right? Did it help? Like, if you were going to try and get some stuff handled in your marriage, is winning the argument the best pathway? Or maybe posing some questions and helping them navigate answers. If you're wanting to get a better marriage, I would tell you winning every argument probably isn't the way. But how you navigate the arguments makes all the difference in the world. Today, I want to talk to you guys about some common sense arguments for the existence of God. Now, to those of you who are skeptics or atheists and you're joining us at one of our locations, I am so glad that you are here. And on the outset, I want to apologize for calling them common sense arguments. I'm just not smart enough to come up with a better term for it. So it is not to say that like you're an idiot or you're weird for not seeing things the way that I see them or that other people see them. It's just more about a philosophical approach or philosophical arguments for the existence of God. So today, we're going to be taking a deep look at some philosophical questions concerning the existence of God. And I'm going to do so, for the most part, without talking about the Bible or using the Bible. And I'm going to do it, for the most part, without talking about Jesus or referencing Jesus. Now, before any of you guys start trying to email me, I am not saying that I don't believe in God or Jesus or the Bible. But if you are engaging in conversations with people on at the philosophical level, to use the Bible and to use Jesus would be, by their definition, circular reasoning, okay? And so I just want to kind of take you through these philosophical arguments through a philosophical lens. Here's why I'm doing this. Every year in the summer, a group of my high school friends get together for a 2 or 3 day camping trip. And every year around the campfire, we end up talking about God. And let me give you a little context. One of my friends is a believer in Jesus. But there is absolutely nothing about his life that even remotely resembles him being a Christian. In fact, he would be like the worst example, okay? Like, you almost want to be like, stop talking about Jesus because that you're not helping the situation. He's the one who every part of his life is always absolutely falling apart, and he is always making the wrong decision. Like, pick up $100 or run a nail through your hand. He will pick the nail through your hand every time. It's just, that's just how he's hardwired. I love him, but that's just him. Another one of my friends has his life completely together. He believes in Jesus, but Jesus to him is more of a Republican president than Jesus on the cross. And so his life from the outside looks very much like a Christian, but there's really nothing in his heart that is Jesus-centered. And then I have a third friend who is a full-blown atheist. And about 11:30 at night on a Friday, they'll start going, "So Clayton, tell us about God." And, you know, which I'm thrilled because, you know, sometimes it's like, "Hey, Clayton, we can't drive anymore. Can you take us to a strip club?" And I'm like, "Nope, we're not doing that." So they're like, "All right, fine, talk to us about God." I'm like, "All right, God's better than glitter." So we, and every year when I'm getting ready to go on this trip, I prep for it. I get all geared up. I want to make sure that I'm ready to handle some of the questions that they're going to ask me. And that's important. I mean, 2 Timothy chapter 4 says this: preach the word. Be prepared in season and out of season. And when I'm getting ready to go on that trip, I know that it's going to be in season. The problem for us as Christians is you're going to have a lot of out-of-season moments. Like, I get a prep for this. It's already on my calendar. I know what's coming. But some of you, you're going to show up at the office tomorrow, and tragedy is going to hit somebody in your office, somebody that you care about. Some of you, you're going to get a phone call this week, and because of things that are happening in their life, they're going to ask you questions, and you're going to find yourself in an, oh, go back 1 second. In an out-of-season moment. And as Christians, we need to be prepared in season and out of season. 1 Peter says it this way: "But in your hearts, revere Christ as Lord. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have." You and I need to have a reasoned answer for every person we come into contact with for the hope that we have in Jesus Christ. But there's a way that we're supposed to do it. He keeps going. "But do this with gentleness and respect, keeping a clear conscience." Which means that it's not just about being prepared to talk to people about Jesus, but the way we talk to people about Jesus matters. As that is our context, I want to walk you through some philosophical arguments for a belief in the existence of God. Now, these things that I'm going to walk you through are questions that everybody has to answer. These are not exclusively Christian questions. They're not atheistic questions or skeptical questions. These are questions that all of humanity has to answer. And how you answer these questions will shape how you live your life. It will shape your worldview. Here's the first question. How do we account for the beginning of the universe? How did the universe come into existence? This is an argument of origin. It shows up in three parts. I'll walk you through them, okay? Whatever begins to exist has a cause. Everything that came into existence had a cause. Something caused it. You came into existence. There was a cause. It might have been Valentine's Day. It might have been some dead flowers in a vase. It might have been some country music or a dimly lit place. But whatever begins to exist has a cause. Second thing, the universe began to exist. Science will tell you this. The universe had a beginning. So the third part is, the universe has a cause. What could cause a universe? Something or someone has to cause the universe to come into existence. That means that something outside of time, outside of space, outside of matter had to be the cause. And for many people, the logical, reasonable conclusion is that there is only one thing outside of time, outside of space, and outside of matter. The name we give him is God. In order for there to be a beginning, you have to have time, space, and matter all come into existence at the exact same time. Let me explain that a little bit more. If you have time and matter but no space, where would you put it? If you have matter and space but no time, when would you put it? If you have time and space but no matter, what began to exist? The Bible answers this question in the first 10 words of the Bible. Count them with me. You ready? In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Watch closely. In the beginning, that's time. God created the heavens, that's space. Earth, that's matter. It gets a little bit more fun than that. You have a trinity of trinities that show up. Time is past, present, and future. Space is length, width, and depth. Matter is solid, liquid, gas. You have a trinity of trinities created by the Trinity. Kind of a weird thing that happens there. Now, the second question we have to ask ourselves is, how do we account for so much design in our universe? This is also kind of broken into three categories. The first one is called specified complexity. So if I were to take all of the parts for an airplane and put them in a big box, like Legos, we would have complexity. We see complexity everywhere. Specified complexity is the difference between all the components for an airplane in a box, and if we could put them all together and we could find a pilot, we could go somewhere nice instead of living where we live, right? We just need a pilot. We have one in Macomb, so we'll make one big enough for all of us. Now, what are the chances that a tornado could go through a junkyard and assemble all of the pieces to make an airplane? I would say slim to none. So how do you account for so much specified complexity? We are marveling right now at some of the advancements in prosthetics, that what hands are being able to do that have been manufactured by mankind, or how legs that are the prosthetics for legs and how much they're able to accomplish. But it's taking all of our human capacity and years of learning and deep research for us to design a leg that works like the leg we already have. How do you account for the fact that what we have by accident is so much better than what we have by our human design? The second thing that we have to navigate is irreducible complexity. This is the difference between motorcycles and mousetraps. So you guys are all getting ready for motorcycle season. I've been hearing you guys crank them up in your garage. I'm super happy for you. I'm glad you guys have those work hours. And while you guys are lighting those things up, now a motorcycle as a means of transportation, you can take an awful lot off of your motorcycle and it still be a mode of transportation. You could take those cool saddlebags off and it would still work. You could take the blinkers off, it would still work. You could take the brakes off, it would still work. You could take the foot pegs off, it would still work. You can keep taking stuff off of your motorcycle and it still be a mode of transportation. You can even take some of the bolts off. And I've seen a couple of you driving around and I'm pretty sure that motorcycle is missing a few bolts, right? But it's still a mode of transportation. However, a mousetrap cannot be reduced whatsoever. It is irreducibly complex. Now, when I'm talking about mousetraps, I'm not talking about these millennial mousetraps that are designed to protect the mice's feelings or anything like that. I'm talking, wham! I'm talking mouse-ending, family tree-shattering mousetraps, right? You know what I'm talking about, those real ones. And if you take a regular mousetrap, every real mousetrap, Christian mousetrap, has five components. It has the platform that everything sits on. It has the spring, it has the lock, it has the trigger, and it has the arm, okay? If you remove any of these things, it stops being a mousetrap. If you remove the arm, it's just a really weird mouse feeder, right? If you remove the lock, it's just a cussing device. I can't set this thing, right? Now, where does this show up in our lives? Well, an easy one to point to would be our eye. Our eye is irreducibly complex. It could not have evolved. It shows up. In order for it to exist, it is irreducibly complex. For instance, the eye cannot work without the presence of the optic nerve to regulate the pressure of the fluid around the eye. The eye without eyelids will not work for long because our eyes require continuous washing and moisture. If you go further, unless there's an eye, there's no point in the duct that's around our eye that produces the tears, or the duct that passes through solid bone that whisks that water away where it dissipates in our nasal cavity as we breathe. All of those things have to come into existence at the exact same time for the eye to work. And then the third piece of the design argument is fine-tuning. As our understanding of science continues to grow, we are becoming more and more aware of how fine-tuned the earth is for the sustaining of life. And scientists have discovered that there are about 150 constants that have to operate in absolute perfection and balance in order for you and I to be able to exist. One of the astrophysicists from Caltech, Hugh Ross, is talking about the ratio between the nuclear force and the expansion rate of the universe, which is one of the constants. And he says it has to be fine-tuned to 1 in 10 to the 37th power. Now, that word or that number means nothing to you, and it means nothing to me. I get it. We're not that kind of smart people. But let me explain to you visually what that would look like. 1 in 10 to the 37th power, Hugh Ross explains it this way. You'd have to take a dime and cover all of North America in one layer of dimes. Then you'd need to add a second layer. And you would keep adding layers until you reached the moon, 238,000 miles away. Then you need to do that on 1 billion additional continents. And then take one dime and spray paint it red and put it somewhere in that mix. Somewhere on the 1 billion continent stacked with dimes, one layer at a time, 238,000 miles high. That is the level of precision for just one of the 150 constants necessary for you and I, or constants necessary for you and I to be in this moment right now. Imagine when we land on Mars with humans and we discover a pocket watch. Our natural inclination would be somebody has been here. Because how would we account for the design of a pocket watch unless there was some kind of watch maker? Maybe watches are too complex. Let's get as simple as we possibly can. Take a look at Stonehenge. Now, you can go home, you can check this. Wikipedia says it this way. Archaeologists believe that Stonehenge was built anywhere from 3000 to 2000 BC. So let me get this straight. We look at a bunch of rocks that have been stacked, and we immediately think, some guy did that. But we look at all the complexities of the universe in our hands and how our cardiovascular system works and everything that's happening inside of our brain, and we think somehow that that evolved without the hand of God. Now, let me show you what I mean by this. You and I, we look at things. Everybody, we look at things, and we instinctively know the difference between random results and deliberate design. If you want to play a joke on your neighbors this week, in the middle of the night, go out, let off a couple fireworks. About 2:30 in the morning. And then in your driveway, right next to your mailbox, put a rock out there. And then tomorrow night, let off another firework at about 3:30 in the morning, and then put another rock on top of it. And when your neighbors are walking their bougie dogs up and down your street, you're like, what's going on out here? Why are you stacking all these rocks? Yeah, we're not stacking rocks. We've been letting off fireworks. Have you been hearing those bangs last night? Well, yeah. We let them off in the front yard, and these rocks just start stacking themselves in the front yard. And you know what they would say to you? Are you okay? Is this a cry for help? They'd look at you a little weird. We look at stacked rocks, and we assume someone stacked them. But we look at a universe, and our natural inclination for so many people is it's just an accident. It's just random. The final philosophical argument, there's a lot more, but the final one that I'm going to do for you today is an argument from morality. It's the moral argument. And the moral argument exists in three parts. Here's the first part. If God does not exist, then objective morals and duties do not exist. I'm going to unpack this way more in 2 weeks. So I'm just giving you like the simplified version today, because in 2 weeks, I'm going to talk to you guys about God and culture and how we as Christians are supposed to live in that tension. But if God does not exist, then objective morals and duties do not exist. Then the second part is this. Objective morality does exist. There are things that we all agree are objectively true, objectively right, objectively wrong. And then the third part would be, therefore, God exists. Let me unpack that. When we hear kids fighting in our house, or when you go on your vacation to the beach and you pick your beach chair, and then somebody comes along and takes all of your belongings off of the beach chair, and then they take your chair. We get into an argument with them about what is fair, about what is right. How would you like it if somebody else treated you that way? We immediately begin to appeal to a higher moral law. And every time we discuss these things, we are talking about something that exists beyond ourselves. This basis for right and wrong exists beyond us. We believe that the person we're talking to knows that this is right and wrong as well, that they sense it. Because when you engage in the argument, they don't argue about whether or not that is real or not, about whether or not they have violated this moral law, what they do, or whether or not the moral law exists. They spend all of their time trying to show you how they didn't violate that higher moral law. How can you fight about what is right and wrong unless there is some level of universal acceptance as to what is right and what is wrong? And anytime you start talking about right and wrong, we are making moral claims. Imagine a country or a civilization where the opposite of the virtues that we hold to be dear were praised. Imagine a country where lying was praised over truth-telling, where stealing was valued above hard work. What about running from battle instead of staying in the fight? That on Veterans Day, we didn't praise all of those who served, but we praised all of those who were dishonorably discharged because they ran from the battlefield. Imagine that the Father of the Year award didn't go to the man who stayed and struggled and provided and suffered along for his family. Instead, the Father of the Year award went to the man who had abandoned the most kids. Imagine that kind of society. See, there are certain qualities that have universal acceptance as standards to be upheld. And anyone who objects to these standards will only object to them until they are on the receiving end of their absence. Somebody who steals from you could make the moral claim, stealing isn't wrong. But then the moment they agree to that and someone steals from them, they will not be going, that's totally fine. They'd be going, how could you do this? Someone who says, you don't have to, you can hit anybody you want. Be fine, until they get punched in the mouth. And they're like, I don't like that moral claim anymore. We all have to live under, and we all know what these are. These moral laws exist within us, but they come from beyond us. There is something or someone pushing us towards a behavior that at times is not in our best interest. So it couldn't be evolutionary. Here's what I mean. God forbid, on your way home today, you see a car that has driven into, or you watch a car drive into a pond, and you know that there are people in there that are on the verge of drowning. And instinctively, you will find yourself caught between two worlds. Knowing that if you were to go into those waters, you could get dragged in, you could get yourself caught up in the seatbelts, and you could get dragged down into the depth of the pond as well. And at the same time, you feel this sense of, I must engage to try to save. Where does that conflict come from? Because all of us would experience it, some in greater degrees than others. But in that moment, it is not about self-preservation that we're being called to. We're being called to something else, something deeper. There is something or someone pushing us towards a behavior that at times is not in our own self-interest. If this did not exist, if this moral law did not exist, we would have no basis for the frustration we feel when people do us wrong or the guilt we experience when we know we do wrong. And where could this have come from? It couldn't have come from our laws, because our laws are simply a reflection of what we already know to be true. We don't need a law that says stealing is wrong for us to know that stealing is wrong. The law just simply recognizes what we all already know to be true. And even if there wasn't a law, when somebody stole from us, it wouldn't rob us, or we would no longer not be under the pain and the feeling of having someone steal from us. So how do you and I move forward? How do you and I navigate this tension? Because if it's not coming from ourselves, then there must be a moral law giver who could judge between what is right and wrong between us. Because if it was subjective, if it was just my moral claims versus your moral claims, who could judge between us? How do you choose who is right and who is wrong? If all truth claims or all moral claims are simply subjective, what right would we have to protest slavery? What right would you and I have to object to sex trafficking? What right did we have to fight against Nazi Germany in World War II? If there wasn't some moral law that was governing us, saying this is wrong and we must do something about it. All of these arguments, the arguments of origin, the arguments from design, the moral argument, are designed to point us to a cause, to a basis. And logically, in my opinion, the most simplistic and the most sophisticated answer is that there is a God who did the creating, the designing, and forms the basis of our moral understanding, that God is writing these codes on our hearts. Why does this matter? I'll tell you. In my opinion, this means there is a God. And if there is a God, that means that I was created by him, and so were you, that you were designed by him, that there are standards that he will hold you and I to. If God exists, then I must know him, and so must you. I must follow him, and so should you. It demands my full acceptance and my complete adherence. I'm trying to say this. If God exists, I believe that he would preserve his word, that he would make sure that you and I have access to the truth. And his word states that there is a life after this life. And those that this life is not all that there is. And that those who do not have a relationship with him at the end of this life, hell awaits. And to those who are in this life, who have an intimate personal relationship with Jesus Christ, on the other side of it, heaven awaits. Which means that as Christians, this becomes our mission to make sure that everybody, everywhere, comes to a knowledge of Jesus Christ. Look what it says in Mark chapter 16. He said to them, this is Jesus, go into all the world and preach the gospel to all creation. What's the gospel? That God sent his one and only son to die on the cross for the forgiveness of our sins. Why do we tell this gospel? I'll tell you why. Because whoever believes and is baptized will be, everybody say this word, saved. This is our mission. This is why we do what we do. But whoever does not believe will be condemned. There is good news here. If you can see that God is real, if you can believe that Jesus is alive, if you can believe that he died on the cross for your sins, 3 days later rose from the grave, what that means is you can come into an intimate personal relationship with Jesus Christ. You don't have to do life alone. You have purpose and meaning and significance and dignity. You are more than just the sum of your parts. You are an image bearer of God. And if you're a Christian, these become our marching orders. This becomes the thing that focuses all the other things in our life. And I hope you'll do that. We're moving to a time of decision. So a while back, Jennifer and I, when we moved to Quincy, we moved into this neighborhood. And our neighborhood is kind of serious about their yards. A little too serious, if I'm being honest with you. About 6 o'clock in the morning, you'll see people out there just, that one leaf was really out of whack. They're raking all the time. They're mulching all the time. They're striping their yards. And then there's us. And we're just kind of like, should we mow it this month? Okay. And we started out, and I was push mowing it. But I was worried that, like, if I became skinny, people would see me as even more vain than I already am. And so I just made the disciplined decision to just keep this body so that way people would lust more and focus on Jesus more. So I bought a riding lawnmower. And I financed it and put it in my wife's name, so my wife has a lawnmower. And I started mowing my yard more frequently. But it still didn't look as good as everybody else in the neighborhood. And part of that's because we have jobs. And they have a lot of free time. But I was like, how do I dominate my neighbors? And I was like, who has the best looking grass? And I'm like, baseball parks, professional MLB parks, they have great looking yards. So I hopped on YouTube and I was like, how do they do it? How do they stripe? And they were talking about, you know, people edging. So I went and I borrowed Denny's edger and I edged my yard. Oh, it looks fantastic. And then I'm watching this YouTube video about how you edge your yard, and the guy who does one of the baseball fields says, if you want to have really straight lines so that way you can, you know, cross-hatch it and checkerboard it and put cool stripes in it, you got to pick something off in the distance, and you got to focus on it, and you drive your mower to it. He goes, if you look at the wheel, your lines are going to get all out of place. If you look just a couple of feet in front of you, your lines are going to get all over the place. You got to pick something in the distance, and you got to focus on it and drive to it. Here's what I think. The moral argument, the argument from design, the argument of origin is God going, look at me. I'm real. Look at me. Come to me and I will make your path straight. God is saying, hey, if you're out there and you're looking for meaning, look at me. You're looking for purpose? Look at me. You're looking for some direction? Look at me. You want some hope? Look at me. You want some hope or help? Look at me. If you're looking for salvation, for rescue, for forgiveness, for grace, for mercy, look at me. If you're looking for love, look at me. You and I, we're looking at our lives and they're not straight, but maybe it's because we've been looking at the wrong thing. And God is crying out to you philosophically, look at me. And some of you, some of us, we kind of get done with our life and we've been mowing and our lines are all jacked up. And then we get mad at God at the results of our lives. But we were never looking at him to direct our life. And then we blame God for the sum of a math question that we didn't invite him into. If you're here today, I've got great news for you. If you've never started a relationship with Jesus Christ, he is a master at lawn rejuvenation. He can make the crooked lines straight. He can take years of damage and he can restore it. In fact, I've seen our God restore things in such a beautiful way that people will say, I mean, I never would want to go through that again. But I got to be honest, because I went through what I went through, I'm in a place I never thought I'd be. That is how good our God redeems. So if you've been spending your whole life not looking at God, you can start looking today. If you're going, I want the hope of heaven in my life, you can believe and you can be baptized and you can start an intimate, personal relationship with him. And so in just a few moments, there's gonna be some people over there by the baptistry that would love an opportunity to talk with you about that. Now, to the rest of you in the room, you already have your relationship with Jesus Christ. Can I level with you? I mean, I love being your pastor, but can I level with you? Sometimes we're like fat people giving diet advice. We're chunky people giving fitness advice. We're trying to tell our neighbors how to mow their yard. And we've never even paid to have our dandelion sprayed. Like, we're trash and we know it, but we're just not admitting it. Like, well, you know what you should do? As Christians, how can we be telling everybody else to look at Jesus in the problems in their life and not look at Jesus in the problems of our own? This is what Paul says. Paul says to a group of people, follow me as I follow Christ. Tough question here. If you were to talk to somebody who didn't know Jesus and you were to tell them to follow Jesus like you, would their life be any better? Would they be making any different decisions? Or do they just have a different calendar appointment on a Sunday morning? It's got to be more significant than that. And so here's what I'm asking you to do. If you're a Christian, I'm asking you to pray that God would help you to start truly following him, truly trusting him. That God would use you as a city on a hill, a lamp on a stand to point people, to draw people to the love of our Savior, Jesus Christ.